Hello, and welcome to recording number 32 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 29th, 2021. Gord had come across Obmi himself and Keek and two guards, and he has opposing as Grat's ambassador. He has dispatched two of Keek and Obmi's guards, but he is now the herald of Obmi. They came across a large a horde of soldiers being sent down by us, led by Ormaz, who is one of the Greater Six, and Patch, who is one of the Lesser Six. And Obmi has convinced, Gord has convinced Obmi to bypass Ormaz because he's told him that he's going to show him up. And that actually was Keek's idea. So Gord, Keek, and Obmi are riding past the line of troops, which are now assembling in this gathering place. And when Gord tried to convince them to stay, there was an immediate attack by Keek. And so now Gord is fighting Keek and Obmi. And that is where I'm going to pick up. It is on page number 316. Now, on page number 317 is a full-page, easily illustration of Obmi throwing his returning hammer at Gord, and Gord ducking just below the flung hammer. All right. It is the second page, 316, second paragraph from the end. Gord ducked low in his saddle, urged his horse ahead, and sent an attack directly at Keek. Obmi was cursing, and his hammer seemed to roar as it passed over Gord's head, ruffling his dark hair. Had Gord not suddenly crouched, the weapon would have struck him full on. His slashing blow struck the elf solidly this time, and the spellbinder gasped in real pain at that. Gord heard the loud whirling of the hammer as it flew back to its wielder's hand. He suddenly realized that dark figures raced past the little drama without bothering to notice what was happening. The call to battle was sounding, and there was no time to spare for a minor roadside dispute. A string of glowing darts leaped from Keek's outstretched hand, and their impact brought terrible pain to Gord's chest. The rush of agony did not prevent his own attack, however. And the razor-like edge of his short sword nearly severed the elf's rigid arm. Keek shrieked in pain at this wound, and Gord managed to get close and deliver a double attack with dagger and sword before the mage could cast another spell upon him. Both blades sank home, and the elf reeled in his saddle. Obmi was cursing nearby, but the dwarf was unable to cast his enchanted hammer into the confused melee for fear of hitting Keek. Flames gushed from Keek's fingertips, searing both Gord and his horse with their licking flames. The animal screamed and reared, throwing the young thief from its back. Gord tried desperately to hold on, but all he managed to do was pull the spear from its lashings as he fell. This slowed his tumble and allowed him to land on his feet, holding the spear. Sword and dagger were somewhere on the ground. A burned horse was gone into the woods, crashing and blundering its way from the torment it had just suffered. Obmi's whirling hammer struck Gord on the shoulder and sent him lurching toward Keek, who was readying a fresh spell. Without considering it, Gord stabbed with the long-bladed weapon, managing to put the point well into the elf's thigh. Then he withdrew the spear quickly, drew it full at the dwarf and bent to retrieve his sword and poniard from where they had fallen. For the cat's vision he now had enabled him to see both weapons clearly. The spear flew true, striking Omni in the chest as he extended his arm to receive the returning hammer. The metal of his armor saved him, for the steel of the spear's head barely pierced his flesh. The blow caused him to drop the hammer, though, and the dwarf was forced to clamber down from his saddle to recover his prized weapon. As an afterthought, Omni flung the spear toward his adversary, but it went harmlessly past Gord and struck a tree bole. To prevent the elven spellcaster from his magical work, Gord slapped the flat of his sword blade across the elf's horse with all the force he could. The animal leaped and bucked, kicking wildly when the blow fell, and Keek pitched from its back, just as Gord had been dismounted but a moment previously. By this time, the dwarf had managed to pick up his hammer and climb back atop his horse, and Gord had to dive to avoid taking another blow from the flying weapon. Gord continued the leap as a series of rolls, flipped to his feet, and struck a blow at the elf as he regained his feet. The blade cut through the robe Keek wore and severed the flesh of his skinny body as it passed, but it was no mortal wound. Gord mentally thanked his patron deities for Omni's decision to leave his other two guards behind as unnecessary encumbrances to his plan. Had those two been here now, the young thief knew he would have been dead. As it was, things were looking very desperate. Keek was babbling rapid, unintelligible syllables now, while Omni kept Gord busy ducking his hurled hammer. Gord decided to try to finish Keek, and then see what the dwarf could do one-on-one. He sprang close and thrust both blades full into the thin body of the elf, just as Keek was loosing his fell Diomer at his adversary. Keek managed a startled squawk, then lunged limply, suspended from the blades that passed through heart and liver. Gord made no sound at all, for he and his weapons had been turned to gray stone. "So much for you both, then," the dwarf hissed, looking upon the strange tableau with some surprise. "Who would have thought a man such as that one could have done for a mage of your power?" Keke mused. "Have you no cackle for me, elf?" "No, I suppose not, for your foul spirit must be screaming its way to the abyss, even as your dead ears fail to hear my words." "But you haven't failed me, Keek. You and Stoat, too, have served me well. My thanks, Stoat, for ridding me of this one, who always schemed to assert me. Keek, you have rid me of one who was bent on my downfall. Of that I am sure. Now I leave you, and you may you rot for eternity in torment." So saying, Omni rode away to the north once again, mimicking the dead elf's maniacal cackling for a time as he went. Break. That is the end of chapter 28, page number 319. A good end to Keek there. I was surprised. I'd almost expected him to, try to turn on Omni at the last minute. You know, it just shows Gord took a string of magic missiles and also a hit by Omni's hammer, and then Keek hit him with probably burning hands. Hit Gord with burning hands. And, so it just shows you that an example of high-level combat. Keek was able to withstand several attacks, and then, Gord was, still on his feet, and only that flesh to stone or whatever it was at the end really stopped him. So now we have Gord, who is, you know, either stone to flesh or something, and Abmi on his way with the second artifact. It leaves me wondering why they would ever have had... I don't know what Gygax was thinking, like I said yesterday, in having Gord not simply start ambushing and taking out the scouts and stuff and try to take out those guys one by one, rather than get himself, you know, joined to Abmi by... Now, there's always this theme that Gord always did like using disguise and, you know, misrepresent himself as something he wasn't, like he took on the mercenary recruiters in Stoink. So I could see that, but it just, this whole thing seems, if Gord is unable to take on... You know, he really was tied up fighting Keek. And Keek really, with the magic, was unpredictable in what he could do. So it does make sense. But if Abmi is, you know, very strong fighter, then he's going to have advantages over Gord if they're of, you know, kind of equal level there. So that was, you know, that was a bit of a strange fight. But again, I like this fight. It did showcase things, and it's much more enjoyable than the business of pulling out the scroll against Nerl, the business with the ridiculous attack by the Green Dragon, Deirdre fighting Bloink and not hearing anything about it. I enjoyed, actually, Gygax is very good at fight descriptions, and it's sad that he skipped over some parts that I think would have been much better told, fleshed out.
It's good to see that Gord doesn't always win.
Yes, and that is, you know, so here Gord is a high level, and I think this fight scene, I'm really thinking that a lot of this stuff that I'm not liking is coming from an editor rather than Gygax himself. I'm betting that this was a manuscript already in the hands of TSR, but maybe not finished up, because by 87, Gygax is gone when this was published. So, I suspect some of the things maybe Gygax was going to, some of those fights might have been detailed, and the business with them fighting Nerl, he did want to get them to the Cat Lord's realm, but, you know, that was... I don't know, maybe that one was as written, but that was the most disappointing to me of all. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 321 and the beginning of chapter 29, first paragraph. A great battle raged in the valley called the Gathering Place by the minions of Uz. Orden Kanan and his captains had set a careful trap. Had Lord Armaz brought Abmi to the place immediately, the plan might just have succeeded, for the whole deployment and attack were well done. But Ormuz did not bring Abmi and the second key to his grand pavilion in the grassy clearing, and a company of unusually careful scouts in Morden Kanan's force discovered enemies lurking at the western end of the Val. Most of these gnolls have been slain on the spot, but a few managed to escape and raise the alarm. Morden Kanan had no choice but to close the jaw of his hidden array and hope that the prize lay within. Bands of wild elves and their sylvan kin were thrust along either side of the valley. Wood gnomes accompanied these elves, and all were hated foes of the humanoids. They would neither give nor ask quarter of Uz's foul troops. At the head of the valley were ranked the soldiers of the Archmage, trained units of men and demi-humans, well armed with bows and arbalists, pole arms, and the full panoply of war. Scattered throughout these stout companies were many minor spellcasters of both clerical and magical sort. While Morden Kanan stood with the Archmage Bigby, the seven other mages and wizards, who, with Bigby, form the magical circle of eight. When Ormuz's camp sounded the alarm, the army of Morden Kanan rallied forth to bring the enemy to battle. All right, break. That's just, I assume, is just awkwardly phrased. But Morden came and stood with the Archmage Bigby, the seven other mages and wizards, who with Bigby formed the magical circle of eight. So, that is, you know, that is a strange thing, is Morden, who, you know, is the circle of eight composed of nine wizards?
That's what it sounds like, and maybe Morden Kanan presides over the eight.
Yes, it's a very strange thing, because I don't think that is noted anywhere else, that either Morden Kanan is above the circle of eight. You know, he's always been thought of, nine wizards in the circle of eight. That could just be, you know, that's very humorous if it's true, you know, that there are nine wizards in the circle of eight. That's why I love these books. I mean, here we've got something that I don't think I've seen noted anywhere else. So that is going to be a little tidbit to toss around. And so we have a note here that, yes, and I should have mentioned this. Abmi is restrained by consideration for others, for Keek, not throwing his hammer into the melee. I found that completely unbelievable. I mean, I would assume, I would assume that Abmi wouldn't have minded seeing Keek, him smashing in Keek with that hammer. I really don't think if he had already seen Gord entangled in the mess, saw that he was dangerous, I don't see any way Abmi would not have thrown his hammer, aiming for Gord, but not minding hitting Keek if it happened. I think that's a little silly on the part here. It really is out of character. But so here we have a little description of Abmi's, not Abmi's, of the battle going on, and this business. But now,
it has him in the Greyhawk box set as Morden Kanan and the Circle of Eight, and it lists eight wizards. So
without Morden Kanan,
yeah,
so that's very interesting. I mean, is it meaning then that Morden Kanan isn't part of the Circle of Eight?
I guess that's true. I don't know. I think he presides over it.
It's so very.
It would be part of it, but
that, you know. Oh, and this is in the 83 box set.
Yeah, on page.
Ow.
12. I'm looking at the City of Greyhawk box set.
So, the City of Greyhawk,
yeah, but the world.
So these aren't the first Circle of Eight. These are the ones that they upended for 2E.
I think it's Tensor, Bigby, Otto, Drumage, Nistel, Rari, Otto Luke, and Jalarzi Salarvian. Yeah,
that is interesting. That's something, I wonder if it's mentioned anywhere. It should be, because that really stands out to me, you know, about Morden Kanan here. All right, so we have that to think about, what that really means, you know, with Morden Kanan in the Circle of the Eight. Now, it's also interesting, are the Circle of Eight all neutrals? Like, are they all on board with Morty's actions, who was actually aiding some of the evil factions so that he could get in and get that second artifact?
I thought Tensor was good.
Yeah, you know, it makes me wonder, although Tenser has that relation with the Cat Lord, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I didn't think the Cat Lord was good. I thought he was neutral.
It says Jalarzy is neutral good.
I thought that name was terrible.
Yeah, it's the heart, and Tenser's lawful good.
Oh, okay. So Tenser's lawful good. Then I wonder if Mordenkainen has just fooled them all about his intentions, you know, in the circle, or at least Tenser, you know, because Tenser wouldn't be in aid of working against the forces of good to aid just Mordenkainen. That's very interesting. All right. It is page 322, second paragraph. I'm going to restart. The two arms of the force held fast in the woods, while the main body of the army came marching across the width of the Val towards the humanoids. Flanking companies were growing stronger as the movement occurred, for as the central mass came closer to the foe, they freed flanking units that likewise moved eastward. The long, inverted U-shape of Mordenkainen's array was slowly changing to resemble a small, tipped C-shape, with the open portion along the secret roadway that ran from south to north within the eastern heart of the sprawling Vesvi forest. All this occurred over a period of hours, of course, with much fighting and magical exchange taking place. Ormuz himself was a potent archmage, and with him was the high cleric called Patch, plus an assemblage of dozens of lesser magic users, clerics, shamans, and witch doctors, the latter two sorts of spell workers being of humanoid sort exclusively. At the first onset of Mordenkainen's host, the servants of the vile Cambion began casting their spells. They were met and answered by the advancing army, of course. Some terrible losses were initially incurred thus by both sides, but the lesser spellbinders were exhausted or slain, while the greater neutralized each other for a time. This brought elves and men into the melee, and ogres, into the melee with gnolls and ogres. The preponderance of archers and disciplined troops belonged to Mordenkainen, while Ormuz possessed a greater weight of soldiers, and ravening creatures such as trolls of all sorts and chimeras, unleashed as hounds by the evil leader of Uz's horde. Minor demons and elementals struggled and fought, while men and demi-humans contested with humanoids and renegade humans. It seemed at first that sheer numbers of foul humanoids would prevail, supported as they were by nearly unkillable trolls, ogres, and the like. Whole rows of screaming zvarts and goblins, gnolls, and hairy bugbears fell to storms of arrows and bolts, but they poured into the valley in the thousands and came on undaunted by the slaughter of their fellows. The stalemate between the spellcasting forces of the opposing armies was illusory, however. Mordenkainen alone was more than a match for the archmage Ormuz, and together with Bigby, he held the enemy in check. Thus the seven other of the circle were free to roam the field. With their power they brought down the trolls, slew the chimeras, and sent the great ogres down into death. Without such creatures to stiffen them, the swarming bands of humanoids and other outlaw humans began to lose heart and retreat. In desperation, Ormuz sought the dwarf Abmi, desiring to hold and use the power of the second key, for that artifact would certainly have tipped the balance in favor of his forces once again. But neither Abmi nor the second portion of the artifact of all evil could be found. Then Ormuz called forth Great Demon, one of the 666 who were the demi-lords of the Abyss. The thing that answered was not Baylor himself, but one scarcely less powerful. The demon demanded a terrible price for service, and Ormuz agreed, for he had no other hope. The huge demon rose with a roar of awful laughter over the battlefield, and the men and demi-humans of Mordenkainen, even those of the Circle, lost heart just as their foes rejoiced and regained courage to fight again at the sight of the terrible bat-winged monster. Mordenkainen himself, mounted on a great cloud dragon, went to meet the demon, and with him went the lords Irage and Felnirith, whose steeds were griffins. At first the contest was even, but both of the armored fighting men, who were sworn vassals of the Archmage, bore weapons that caused the demon harm. Both of these brave men attacked fearlessly, and as the demon turned to combat their attacks, Mordenkainen sent his spells at the monster. The demon withstood most of the power so sent, the magic seeming to fall harmlessly away, but not all of these attacks were resisted. A great plane of force nearly tore the dark wing from the demon's right shoulder, while both Arash and Doughty Felnirith smote him with their swords. The fiend flew straight for the Archmage then, grappling with the dragon he rode to cause the rider to cease the painful deomers he sent upon his scaled hide. Both dragon and rider were prepared, and as the drake closed its great jaws upon the demon, Mordenkainen actually reached forth over his dragon's neck and laid his hands upon the demon, drawing its power from it. The demon was already much weakened by its fighting, and the dragon was clutching it fast, and its claws while it bit and tore with its teeth. When the Archmage released the demon's energy by his touch, the thing uttered a shrill scream that was audible over the whole battlefield. Heads turned upward at the sound, and the forces who fought for us saw their champion collapse into itself, imploding with a dull, sucking noise that was followed by a thunderclap as air rushed in to fill the void where the huge demon had been. The concussion sent all three men and their riding creatures spinning downward, stunned and helpless. Despite this, the battle had turned in favor of Mordenkainen's army, and their troops advanced with a roar when the demon was slain. At that moment, both Ormuz and Patch sought to use their powers to escape the coming disaster, but Bigby had drawn near enough during the combat overhead to cast a disjunction of magical forces over the pavilion where the two servants of Uz were. Unable to escape, both Ormuz and Patch sought to sell themselves as dearly as possible. In the end, both died, however, while Mordenkainen and his two vassals, Irage and Felnirith, as well as the Cloud Dragon, managed to survive their fall. The victory was by no means complete. It was a hollow one, in fact. The circle did not close properly, and many of the humanoids and brigands managed to escape. Many of Mordenkainen's troops had been slain or wounded, just as the Archmage and his lords were hurt. Wow. Three members of the magical band commanded by Bigby had met irrevocable death. The victory was, wow. First of all, the reason for the battle had proved fruitless. No second key was there for the taking. Lamenting his failure, even as clerics healed his wounds, Mordenkainen the Archmage, commander of the Obsidian Citadel, realized suddenly that beings of vaster power than his own had manipulated him, just as he had sought to manipulate others to gain the key. Laughing ruefully at this joke, he wondered if perhaps there weren't strings moving those who had moved him. The work of finding and aiding the wounded, burying the dead, and clearing the battlefield went on all the next day. Freed from his duties, the elven fighter mage Melf toured the area to observe at first hand the whole of what had been accomplished by the defeat of the Horde of Uz. There was much loot, but his lieutenants would see that his share was properly allotted. for the elves who had fought under his command had performed heroically. In fact, Melf had personally slain several ogres and trolls as well, after having spent all of his magical power against the enemy. At the trampled place where paths met, Melf discovered a stone statue of a man. Crushed beneath this toppled lith was a barely recognizable elf. It took only a moment to carefully remove the statue. Melf was incredibly strong, and he did the work alone. Then he emptied his canteen upon the stony form to wash some of the stains away. Finally, he searched the stiff corpse that had been Keek, the renegade elven mage, finding no clues as to Abmi's whereabouts, but keeping several items of possible use discovered in the process. That done, he rounded up a few soldiers to stand guard over the statue, telling them to remain on duty until he could return. All right, so, now, one of the key things I notice here is that Bigby, three of Bigby, the people who were under Bigby's command. Now, I don't know. Does that mean three of the circle of eight members? Would they be under Bigby's command? Or are these simply mages of lesser power than Bigby who served Bigby? Because as we can see, the individual members of the Circle of Eight usually have their own retinue. There were all these people sworn to Mordenkainen. Melf was sworn. Iraj and Falnaroth, they were all sworn to serve Mordenkainen. So I'm wondering if Gygax meant that three Circle members were killed, or simply three vassals of Bigby.
I think he would have spelled it out more if it was the circle.
I'd hope so, because I don't think we're getting any other information. The possibility exists, but, they're supposed to be irrevocably slain. So that would remove them. Now, at this point, with this TSR story, I don't know if that would, actually happen, where he'd kill off some of his named circle members. We have that this Jalarzy replaces somebody at a later date, so I don't know. It's possible there could have been one circle member slain, at that point. All right. I thought that was Gygax is really good at describing these fights, and even high level fights such as this. I thought, a very exciting little fight there, and it just makes me sad when he doesn't do that all the time. All right, I am going to restart. It is page number 325 and paragraph 3. "Be damned to hell," Gord cried, jerking his dagger and sword free. Then he started and stared. No enemy stood before him. It was day, and he had just pulled his blades from nothing but air. "Relax, Gord," a familiar voice said from behind. "All is well." He tried to turn with cat-like speed, ready for any new enemy. But instead, Gord managed only a creaky and doddering step and nearly fell to the ground. His limbs felt like stone, and his head ached fearfully. Every time his heart beat, there was a pounding in his ears and a throbbing pain in his brain. "What's wrong?" he said aloud to himself. Melf, at a distance where any initial swing with sword or dagger would not harm him, spoke to Gord again. "Move slowly and do not attempt anything strenuous for the next few hours. You've just been returned from a stone statue to flesh and blood again, and your systems are in need of some time to restore themselves." "And Keek managed to escape," Gord said softly. walk there beside that tree. You skewered that crazy bastard fairly before he managed to petrify you. That's of no import at this time, though. Tell me, what became of Keek's master, the dwarf Obmi? Gord sat down on the hard-packed earth and told Melf all that had occurred last night. These details filled in a picture that the elf was all too sorry to view. The filthy little bugger has certainly gotten away again. And at least a full day's start, too, fumed Melf. Perhaps there is still a chance. I'll tell Lord Mordenkainen of this, and he may be able to find Obmi and gain the second key yet. At that moment, Gord was feeling awful, sick and dizzy and too weary to care what became of the artifact. Melf started to leave then, stopped, peering into the sky to the north, where a huge black cloud had suddenly gathered. "Either that's a bad omen, or I am no mage," he exclaimed. "I mislike that, Gord. Look at the shape of that cloud. What does it resemble?" "I don't know," Gord replied, trying to focus his bleary eyes. "Maybe it's a giant toadstool with a pointy lump atop it." "The lump rather looks like an old crone in a tall hat, doesn't it?" There was no reply. Gord stopped his useless peering at the cloud, looking instead for Melf. The fighter mage had gone. "Without a goodbye, or giving me a chance to properly thank him," Gord mused, "he just vanishes. I'm beginning to think that all elves are flighty, if not as mad as Keek was." He groaned and struggled erect unsteadily. Remembering the spear, he tottered amid the nearby trees, and a moment later appeared on the pathway. He walked unsteadily with the help of the spear, but his clothing was dirty. Nonetheless, Gord was making his way southward in the direction his comrade awaited. Behind him, unnoticed, the black cloud grew denser still, settled to the ground, and then wafted away as quickly as it had gathered. All right, that is a breaking here. It's page 326 and the end of chapter 29. Now, I think that that cloud is obviously Zugmoti and Yggdrasil, you know, some type of sending from them or, you know, dramatic appearance. You know, this whole last chapter is mostly battles here. So we really don't gain all that much insight, even into most characterization. I think one of the strangest things was that Ormuz and Patch, they didn't surrender. They tried to sell their lives as dearly as possible. So, did it say that they tried to surrender first?
I didn't hear that. It seems like they died bravely.
Yeah, and that is certainly a change, than what was...
It says they sought to use their powers to escape.
Yes, but they didn't surrender, at least.
Mm-hmm. They didn't grovel and, you know, try to sell somebody out.
Yeah, and normally what's been happening is everybody has betrayed everybody else who's on the evil side. So Ormuz and Patch are the exception to that they went down fighting. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 327, chapter 30. First paragraph. "Something dampens our powers, Lord of Evil," the mage Vane explained nervously as Uz strode into the scrying chamber atop one of the greater towers in his dreadful palace. "If there are others were here, I'm certain we could get through, but with nothing but petty little weaklings to assist me, I can do nothing," the magic user whined in his fearful nasal voice. "Stop that," the Cambion said without looking at the anxious man who scuttled a pace behind him. Uz was in his massive demonic form, and his long legs propelled the corpulent mass of his red-skinned body along at a pace that Vane found difficult and undignified to keep up with. The Cambion liked that, for the whining spellbinder had to come flapping after him, or else risk his displeasure. Uz stopped before a massive vessel of beaten copper and brass. The inky stuff within it was dead black. The surface should have reflected an iridescent sheen. Strange. You see, look, silence, Uz bellowed, and Vane nearly collapsed in fear at the command. Why is it so dark in here? The Cambion demanded. It had suddenly grown particularly gloomy in the chamber, and the shaking magic user hastened to a nearby window to find the cause. There is a great mass of clouds overhead, Lord Uz, as black as I have ever seen. Perhaps some enemies send weather magic against us. His master wasn't paying the slightest bit of attention to his words, so Vane allowed his sentence to trail off. Uz was still at the scrying basin, peering into the thing fixedly. Little man, I feel that some event of great import is about to occur. It is of favorable sort, I'm certain. Be gone when I cease my speech, and I'm through talking. This statement was punctuated by the slam of the chamber door. Uz smiled an eerie, evil smile, and then he concentrated on the liquid. Instead of growing lighter, the absolute blackness of the surface increased, as if the stuff was absorbing what little illumination fell on it. The Cambion bent closer, then leapt back when undignified haste. The oily liquid in the massive pool erupted in a geyser that struck the ceiling almost 20 feet above its surface. As the droplets pattered down throughout the room, a pair of women appeared. Before Uz's startled gaze stood Yggdrasil, his mother, and Zuckmoy, demoness lady of fungi. Between them, grasped by both, was the second key. For one who calls himself the Eldritch Lord of Evil, you look rather startled. Thunderstruck is the word. Weren't you expecting us? Yggdrasil said, and as she asked the question, she smirked at the figure beside her. Zuckmoy the demoness smirked back at the crone, who was possibly the oldest and most powerful human ever known, then smiled broadly at the Cambion. Uz, my love, it has been too long. Recovering his lost dignity, Uz drew himself up to his full height and spoke with firm tones. Both of you assume a more pleasing form immediately, but first you may hand me that which you have brought. Yggdrasil shook her head. Not so fast, my prodigal. Is that any way for a devoted son to speak to his dear mother? Even as she shuddered this admonition, the ancient crone, one who had appeared a parody of every child's nightmare of a wicked witch, changed. Her features flowed and changed as her body grew and straightened. Scraggly gray locks became flowing tresses of hair like spun gold, and face and form matched the radiance of this golden head. You brought me forth by accident, and you have been more a mother in the breach than the office, Yggdrasil. Cease your foolery and deliver my prize to me, the Cambion added with what could have been petulance. Zuckmoy, too, had altered form from a horrid harridan to a breathtaking beauty, as voluptuous as her companion. Zuckmoy's assumed form was as dark as Yggdrasil's was golden. As this occurred, the demoness swayed across the intervening distance between them and threw her arms around Uz. Greet your lover properly, she demanded in sultry fashion. And you too, Wilva. Come and join us, do. Break. All right, so we get... There's no real, you know, kind of description of Zuckmoy or Yggdrasil since they can change form at will. But I do like that Zuckmoy calls her Wilva. I'll have to make sure to note that down as one of Yggdrasil's, as Wilva. Again, they've obviously run into Obmi and relieved him of that artifact. And I had thought, yeah, Betty and Wilva there, yeah. That is funny. But so I don't believe Obmi's been killed. I just think we definitely Keek's gone, but I don't think Obmi. And looks like they're going to hand it over to Uz, which really surprises me with Yggdrasil and such a powerful demoness is not simply keeping the second artifact for themselves. So I'm a little surprised by that. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 329. And it is the third paragraph down. "Stop this foolishness," the Cambion said, trying to disengage Zuckmoy's arms with one hand and fend off the giggling Yggdrasil with the other. Uz dared not offend the one and wished for nothing more than the artifact held by the other. This was not in keeping with his dignity or nor power. "I demand you stop this now." "Demand," said Zuckmoy. "Demand," echoed Yggdrasil. The hard edge of both voices made the Cambion hastily rephrase his statement. "My dearest love, my own mother, you have confused and befuddled me with your coming, with that which you bring me, and most of all with this fond greeting." With that he clasped the dark form that was Zuckmoy and embraced her lasciviously. As he laughed, as she laughed, Uz scooped the transformed Yggdrasil into the expanse of his other arm and kissed her too. "There, my most lovely ladies, I make amends." Releasing them, Uz proceeded to kiss each of their hands in a courtly fashion, greeting each by full title and welcoming them to his abode. Yggdrasil smiled, and there was a suggestion of mockery and sly understanding in the expression. "Uz, my son, you excel yourself in the choice of consorts. Lady Zuckmoy is absolutely without peer." "Thank you, dear Yggdrasil," the transformed demoness said prettily. "I'm in your debt, and you will never regret aiding me." "Sich, don't mention it. Time for settling that will come. You and I have much to accomplish now," she added, giving the Queen of Fungi a meaningful glance. "What?" Uz began. "Of course the woman had given him birth," said. "You are wanting information. Well then, attend me." It was a near thing, for those soft and stupid ones who opposed the true order of things came in their multitudes. "Despite their mewling attempts, I found and freed dear Lady Zuckmoy. Together we went to her lovely estate in the abyss, where she renewed herself. What wonderful chats we shared, and what plans we schemed, Lady Zuckmoy and I. Then, as time was of the utmost, we returned to this mundane plane to set matters on the correct course here." "Second key. From where did you get it?" Uz interrupted. "This," Yggdrasil feigned a negligent disdain for the oddly twisted shape of dull metal and lusterless crystal of dusky hue she still held. "It radiated a dim aura which was discernible to us when we melded our powers and considered it," Yggdrasil told the Cambion. "So we changed ourselves and went unnoticed to where it was. It was a simple matter to take it and bring it here. Once possessed, its power is such that only a major combination could prevent we two from doing as we wished. Did a dwarf called Obmi bear it?" That one was heading directly for a large group of puissant elves, the snot-nosed servant of that upstart Mordenkainen. How that silly trickster howled when we took the prize before his own dogs could snap it up. the dwarf. Yggdrasil smiled and gestured to Zuckmoy. The demoness reached into the low bodice of her gown and withdrew a large, exceptionally ugly toad. This is the very same dwarf you spoke of, Abmi. No matter, toads are such dear little things that I had to have them. They love to sit on my fungi, you know. The demoness concluded as she tapped the cowering Atrecian on its warty head. So be it, Uz said with a shrug. He failed, or nearly so. If you wish him as a pet, he is yours until you tire of him. The Queen of Fungi laughed a delightful little laugh and replaced the toad within her bosom. You're so thoughtful, dear Uz. All right, a break here. Chris has posted a couple of images, I believe,
One is Zuckmoy, and the second is Uz and Yggdrasil.
Ah, cool.
From Return of the
Oh, okay. No wonder I don't. Yeah, I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, I don't know where the first one's from. I mean, they were on Greyhawk Online, but I didn't see a credit.
Okay. But Return of the Apes, the Eight, is not surprising. It is not a favorite module of mine.
Yeah, I thought it was a cool picture, though.
Yeah. All right. We're getting, we hear about the end of the battle from the point of view of Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy. Poor little Abmi's been turned into a frog. But really, you know, there's the biggest thing here is, again, Uz, you know, notice how Uz backs down from, you know, his normal way of acting in the petulant, petty, spoiled sort of way. When he's presented with overwhelming power, he backs down, and he's trying to act courtly and gentlemanly to at least he has an understanding of what that means. You know, it's not just he's not just brought up totally evil. He's totally evil, but he also understands how people should act politely. And that's, I think, very amusing. You know, he's not just a product of all evil. He's also that courtliness that is seen as respect and positive among these evil creatures. Batrachians, yes, little different frogs there. I'm probably not saying that right, but it's best I can come up with at the moment.
Yeah, it sounds good to me.
All right, we still have about 7 minutes. I'm gonna go a little further, and we are very close to the end of the book. But I learned my lesson from Artifact of Evil, how we went on for over two hours plus at the ending there, and I thought we could just get right through it. So, restarting, page 331, paragraph 1. It is nothing, the Cambion said with forced generosity. Yggdrasil interrupted them. Come, my dears. Let us get to matters of import. My little Uz has a kingdom to expand. There are plans to make. But first there must be a triumphal procession and festival here in Daraka. The populace must know of our coming, of the new power of the land, and of its new status as arbiter of all. Uz groaned inwardly, cursing Yggdrasil carefully in a corner of his mind that was well shielded from any possible prying by magic. Now, the Cambion thought, I understand why Grazd imprisoned her in a dismal plain within the abyss. Yggdrasil, it was certain, would not settle for a role of silent helper in matters of state, or any other matters. In tandem with Zuckmoy, and the two seemed to have become virtual sisters, they would never allow him his prerogatives, nor a moment's peace. Pay attention, as Yggdrasil said with a scolding tone that didn't fit her charming beauty at all. You were always a daydreaming little do-nothing as a youngling, but that won't be the case anymore. Yes, as do attend our words, added Zuckmoy. If we are to rule in a fitting state here on this silly little world, you must be able to do your part, so pay attention. Let's break. So here Uz is being talked of as a bad little boy.
Yeah, it's being chastised by his mom and his girlfriend.
Yeah. Here's a little comment about Hecate is a Greek witch or Greek deity.
Yeah, I think she turned Odysseus's men into pigs.
No, that was Circe.
That was Circe. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe a god then. I'll look.
Yeah, I don't remember offhand, but her name in Greek apparently means willing, she who works her will, and it's being thought here that maybe that is where Yggdrasil comes from. And the Ig sounds like one of Gygax's, you know, names pulled out of Gygax, you know, like Eggsville, you know, Eggville instead of Yggdrasil. So yeah, her name, you know, is very odd. Now, she is immensely powerful, and it's like this is saying she may be the oldest and most powerful human. Now, I use her goddess of magic. Yeah, Hecate is goddess of magic. And I use her as appearing both as in Blackmoor as Louis, who is the, evil Finnish magic using woman, and as Baba Yaga, who is the Slavic version of Louis, and as the crone. And then Yggdrasil, and that is that's just what I'm doing now. In they definitely have a Baba Yaga as someone separate from Yggdrasil in Greyhawk, so but it's also questionable whether that you would use Baba Yaga in Greyhawk. Now, I do. I like that, but I don't think she's any recognized part of the setting. And Yggdrasil kind of works in that aspect, and she could easily appear as the crone. All right, we're just about done. I'm going to leave it here because we don't have much for the last show, and so tomorrow we're going to finish the book. There's only 52 pages and a few blanks. We're on page 331. And so that is going to leave us just with 21 pages for tomorrow. May not be a full hour. Now, I did like getting this various character of Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy. They are, with Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy, their characterization was rather amusing. Having them as evil and playful. So, and definitely taking, now I don't see how they can ever give the second key to us, because it's what power they hold over. Because even together, I'm not quite sure if the two of them are more powerful than us himself. But definitely the two of them with the second key. Now, I can't remember where things go after this, but I can't see them being able to give him possession of that key, because he is a very vengeful, petty little half-demon. And I really can't see him, if he gets able to, you know, flip the scales here and become the more powerful one, even at his own expense. They have really, really been insulting to him, so.
Yeah, and we can be pretty sure he's vain.
Yeah. So anyway, I just, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'd assume that the way Gygax wrote this, this was going to occur, whatever happened. I really liked the last battle, and I think he might have had this conclusion kind of written up, you know, ahead of time. Sometimes writers write in scenes. Like, they might write the final encounter first and then work their way up to it. Abmi did, you know, did seem to be able to escape. I don't understand how they were able to find him, per se. Because, supposedly, like we just saw, all the scrying has gone astray. You know, that it's been very hard to see into the future, to do communication, you know, for everybody on the earthly plane here. So, you know, I'm a little surprised. But again, I don't think that's the strongest. I do, at the end of this book, I do have a kind of feeling that it's all, it's a little too set up for me, you know. Us ending up with this feels like it was too much of an inevitable conclusion. That's just as far as the story goes. There was quite a bit of interesting tidbits here on Morden Keenan, his, you know, this question on the Circle of Eight. Is it really the Circle of Nine? You know, Morden Keenan's role in it, I thought, was to be the chief of the Circle of Eight, and I didn't assume that he was outside of it. I assumed it was Morden Keenan and seven other magicians. Mm-hmm. All right, we're at 7:02, and I'm afraid I gotta run tonight, so I'm gonna say goodbye and kick out Craig here.
All right, good night.
Hopefully, talk to you tomorrow. See ya. Night, Jim.